Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does hunger for knowledge shape a person's life, and what does it take to cultivate wisdom along with the acquisition of information? The heroine of Elizabeth Gilbert's new novel, The Signature of All Things, is Alma Whitaker, a woman born at the start of the 19th century when curious and passionate amateur scientists emerged as an important source of empirical data about the natural world. Alma's single-minded desire to understand botany helps distract her from the loneliness of life as a single woman in an era when marriage was assumed to be a woman's most important aspiration, but it also keeps her from recognizing how much she is loved by the people closest to her. Elizabeth Gilbert was a National Book Award finalist for her nonfiction book, The Last American Man, and is perhaps best known as the author of the memoir Eat, Pray, Love, and the one that followed, Committed. She is in town to speak tonight at the Authors Live event at Highland Park United Methodist Church, and she joins us now to talk about The Signature of All Things. Liz, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I'm so happy to be here.
So how did you find your way to this story, and what did it take to be able to put this story into the proper historic and the proper scientific context?
A lot. I'm sure I can answer that more specifically. I'm a very passionate gardener of late, and I knew that whatever I was going to write next was going to have to be a book about plants, or it wouldn't hold my own attention. I think you should always start with the thing that you're most curious about at that moment in your life. And the most interesting moment for me in plant history was this very privileged moment between the end of the Age of Enlightenment and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the era of the great pre-Victorian and Victorian amateur scientists and taxonomists who went out and tried to chart the world and decode the mysteries of life through the study of the natural sciences. And I wanted to place a woman into that field because botany was the only science that was even a little bit open to women, because it was associated with plants and flowers, which are sort of considered feminine pursuits.
Ladylike, that's right.
Ladylike, yeah. I feel like women kind of snuck in through the garden gate into botany. And once they were in there, they made some really amazing contributions. And so that began my investigation. And then I think I did about 3 years of research before I even started writing.
So 3 years of research. And then, as I understand it, you wrote the book within a few months.
Yeah, very quickly. Because I over-prepared, I think. I was intimidated. It's only my second novel. And my first novel I wrote 16 years ago when I was much younger and a less competent and confident writer than I am now. And I didn't really know how to write a book when I was writing my novel long ago. So I don't have happy memories of writing fiction. And I wanted to do it again, but I feared that it would be a difficult, painful, bloody-knuckled experience. And so I just tried to give myself every benefit I could by preparing as hard as I could. And then once I got started, I realized, God, I've gotten a lot better at this job in the last 16 years, as most of us do if you stay at one pursuit for a long time. And I'm really ready to tell this story.
Well, time is a really interesting theme throughout the novel, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I'm curious as to whether time moves in different ways for you when you're researching as compared to when you're sitting down and really writing.
Well, you know, I lived in Indonesia for a while, and in Indonesia they famously talk about something called rubber time. They have much looser and I think more creative and probably more accurate ideas about what time is. You know, an hour spent at the Department of Motor Vehicles is really different than an hour spent at your favorite concert or something, right? Like, we know that time moves differently when we're in different states of mind. And so I've always sort of been aware of that. I also feel like there are years of our life that weigh more than others. You know, I went through years of depression, and those years feel like a decade when it was really only 3 years. Years of happiness spin by so quickly. So I really wanted to play with that in the book. And also because Alma is a naturalist who's investigating the mechanism behind species transmutation and evolution and a lot of questions that were going on in the 19th century. And a lot of those questions are based in the question of time. You know, how long does it take for fins to develop? How long does it take for wings to develop? How long does it take for an eyeball to emerge? How old is the Earth? These were questions that they were struggling with as well.
And time, I mean, the early part of her life goes by and she's intensely focused on studying, but she becomes aware, once she becomes obsessed with moss and mosses, that the time of her life is like a heartbeat as compared with this thing that she wants to study. And so there's like an urgency even in the midst of a life that is, to many people's eyes, would appear to be sort of playing out slowly.
Yeah, there's a line in the book where it's said of Alma that her life was a book that opened to the same page every day, mm-hmm. you know, for at least until she was 50 and her big adventure began. But up until that point, her life is very steady. It's very repetitive, but it's not unpleasant because she's dissolved in the work that she loves, which is a passionate desire to understand mosses and to figure out the differences of the species and what's happening in the battles that they're waging in very slow amounts of time. And she comes up with this theory that there are these different sorts of time. There's divine time that is sort of the time of God that is almost eternal. There is geological time that she's learning about because she's following the scientific debates of the day and learning about the fossil evidence and the fact that continents are not where they used to be. And then there's moss time, which is very fast compared to geological time, mm-hmm. but incredibly slow compared to the other time she mentions, which is human time. And her comprehension is that it is just, we're like mayflies. We're here and then we're gone. And she has this tremendous urgency to learn as much as she can in that tiny amount that she's allotted. And there's a bit in the book where she says, muses, that if the mosses knew how soon she would be gone, they would pity her because their colonies last for thousands of years. And I feel like that when I get excited about my work, that there's so much to do and I'm going to be gone so fast. I've always had that sort of hanging over my head. I think it's what's driven me. And so that's an aspect of her that I felt that I could intimately relate to.
I love it when she realizes that this is what she wants to dedicate her life to. And mm-hmm. there's this beautiful line, and I have it written down, but I can't find it with my eyes. Is it, praise be the labors that lie before me. Yeah. Let us begin. I love that.
Ah, oh, thank you. Well, you know, what it was is that I needed her to find something that would occupy her. And I think that's what I really devoted the first half of the book to, is this idea of what do you do if you're a woman and it's pre-feminism by a large margin. Mm-hmm. You have a tremendous mind. You've been very overeducated thanks to her unusual family and her academic mother. But there are no avenues of option for you. And you are your father's helper and partner, and you're sort of running the family estate because your mother's died. And you can't go anywhere. But you have this tremendous, ranging, capacious, hungry mind. What do you feed it with? And there's this period of Alma's life where she falls into this kind of despair of panic, where she feels like the life is too long and my thoughts are too hungry, and what am I going to do with it? And then she discovers these beds of moss within walking distance of her father's estate and realizes that in 10 lifetimes she would not be able to comprehend everything that was going on there. And the relief is so huge. And I know that because I've had moments in my life where I'm like, I'm stuck in this town, I'm stuck in this city. What am I going to do? What am I going to occupy myself with? And you feel your brain sort of pacing until you can find something to give it to chew on.
She does. Okay, so she's published a couple of books, and then finally she has what will be her masterwork. And she hesitates. She doesn't want to get rid of it. Maybe it's not ready. And I'm wondering how much of that is a reflection of how you felt after having, many people don't know, you had a great deal of critical success before Eat, Pray, Love. Mm-hmm. But then after that, everybody was sort of waiting with their breath held to see what would come next.
Right. Well, you know, Alma's hesitation to publish comes from a different place, actually. I'll answer those questions in two separate categories. For one, my position was different from hers in that I was so widely known and everybody had already kind of decided who I was, for better or for worse.
Right. Right or wrong.
Right or wrong. Like the vote was cast and everybody was sort of determined. And there's a weird liberty that can come with that. I know it seems counterintuitive, but once I kind of thought my way through it as creatively as I could, I thought, well, there's something kind of fantastic about everybody having decided that they know exactly what you are, because then you can be whatever you want, because there's no point in trying to convince anybody.
You're
anyway,
not going to change their mind.
Right? So yeah. You might as well just do the work that you really, really want to do and then throw it in the world and see what happens. And that's, of course, what this novel is. It's the book I wanted to write for mm-hmm. my own reasons and for my own delights and joys. In Alma's case, what holds her back from publication is something that I am lucky enough not to have experienced, which is her own perfectionism. I feel like I'm very fortunate that that's not an aspect of my personality. And I think it's because I grew up with a mother who always taught us that done is better than good.
You know, there's some value to
there
that.
There is. Just get it out there. Get it done. The dishes don't have to be totally clean. They just have to be mostly washed. You know, like we just had a kind of haphazard style in my household about just getting as much finished as you could. Alma, on the other hand, is empirical. She's a didact. She's a perfectionist. And the theory that she's come up with is really radical and really kind of world-changing. And she's hesitant to publish it because she feels it's not quite there. And I also wanted to tell that story as part of her life because I feel like it's a cautionary tale, because I think it's especially a problem for women that we hold back. I should say they, because I don't happen to do this, but I see it happen in a lot of my friends and women who I love dearly. They hold back their work, whatever that work might be, because they don't want to put it out there until it's beyond criticism or until it's perfected. And of course, perfection doesn't exist. And also creating something that's beyond criticism doesn't exist. And so they pull back when they should be pushing forward. And Alma does the same.
My guest is Elizabeth Gilbert. She is the author of a brand new novel called The Signature of All Things, and she's in town for an appearance tonight at Highland Park, United Methodist Church. That event, you can find information about it on the Think page of KERA.org. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@KERA.org. We want to update you on the status of our fall fundraising campaign. $25,610 left to go from listeners, thanks to the amazing day-long matching grant from our amazing KERA board member and supporter, Donna Wilhelm. Jeff Whittington joins us now. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I want to thank Paul McGinnis in Dallas, Ann Taylor in Springtown, Margaret and Andrew Richter in The Colony, and Shelley Baker in Keller. They've all either called 888-694-6931 or they've contributed online at kera.org. And Chris, you're absolutely right. Donna Wilhelm, a very generous supporter and board member of KERA, has agreed to match every contribution today. Now, we kind of have to finish this membership campaign today to take advantage of this, because that's the whole idea, is to get back to the regular schedule, the regular work. And also realize that, you know, these programs have a cost. It sounds like it's free when you turn on the radio, but it's really not. And Donna is encouraging you, as we've been doing for a number of days, to take responsibility for your public radio station, make a $10 a month contribution. We'll be happy to thank you with your very own copy of Elizabeth Gilbert's new book, The Signature of All Things. And you know what? Donna's going to match that $120 contribution dollar for dollar.
Yeah, it really is. It's a great deal for the station. It's a great deal for you. I got to tell you, I truly love this book. I've already sold more copies to my friends and relatives and people by by raving about it. So everyone that I've convinced to already go out and buy it, you'll just have to make your contribution and take another thank you gift if you want to do that. But it's really, really interesting. We are thrilled to be able to have it for you. We're especially thrilled that we're able to bring you a guest like Liz Gilbert. That's the benefit of having a show like Think that is produced here in North Texas for this audience. We know a lot of you listen outside of the broadcast area, but if you listen to the podcast, we would ask that you support Think as well and support KERA with a contribution to KERA.org or 888-694-6931.
Maybe you've noticed that the audio quality of Think interviews has improved some lately. We're spending a little bit more time and making an investment in working with other stations and studios around the system. Maybe you've noticed the expansion in our news department. We've added some positions in the KERA newsroom. We've added a digital editor. If you log on to KERANews.org in the morning and you read the high five, then you know the great work of our digital editor, Eric Austin. He was also the only journalist to live blog from the day-long JFK symposium that happened on Saturday here in Dallas. And we were really thrilled to bring you that coverage. But you know what? That has a cost as well. It costs money to bring you the news and information, the conversation, the intellectual stimulation that you get and want from public broadcasting in North Texas. And we're asking you today to help defray some of that cost with a contribution. 888-694-6931 or on the web at kera.org.
Your contribution makes you really a patron of quality journalism, quality news and information, deep discussion that is not summarized in a single soundbite. It's you know that there are not other places you can find that on the broadcast dial in North Texas. So please support it now, 888-694-6931 or kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Elizabeth Gilbert.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Elizabeth Gilbert. She is perhaps best known for writing the memoir Eat, Pray, Love. She was a National Book Award finalist for The Last American Man, and her new novel is called The Signature of All Things. She's in town to speak at Highland Park United Methodist Church this evening. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. What does it take to get the cadence of 18th century speech in your mind, or at least the cadence that a 21st century reader can follow along easily?
Yeah, that's a distinction, too, because I didn't want to write a book that was pretending that it had been written in 1802. I thought that would be really affected and maybe off-putting to the reader. So it's certainly, I feel like it's a contemporary novel about a long ago time, which is a kind of subtle difference, but it made it easier for me to write. That said, I don't want any anachronisms in there, and I wanted the dialogue especially to feel right. And the only way I figured out how to do it is to read thousands of letters, because letters are where you hear the closest approximation to live speech, especially in the Victorian era, where people who were literate and who were engaged in the world were writing 10, 20 letters a day. It was their email, it was their phone calls, it was their voicemail messages. And it's so different even from reading journals and diaries, because journals and diaries tend to be very self-conscious, because the person is aware that somebody may read it, or it's for posterity, or they're working through something in a very deliberate way. When you're writing 10 letters a day, sometimes you're writing angrily, sometimes you're writing passionately, sometimes you're sad. The emotions are sort of raw, and the voice is raw. And especially if there's three mail deliveries, one in the morning, one, you know, if you're like continuing the correspondence of the day, you can see these dialogues going on where you can hear people speaking to each other. And so I pulled a lot of sort of speech patterns out of the mail and ancient mail in order to get the dialogue feeling accurate.
And then the idea of, you know, that communication being really important to people. And I thought about someone like Alma, who she goes on a journey. I promise not to give any major spoilers here, but she does go on a journey, and she's on a ship for months on end. And then you sort of drop it in at the very end. And, you know, she got off the ship and basically never heard of, you know, anyone aboard again.
Yeah.
And the idea of building these intimate relationships with people, whether you wanted to or not, even if they're just a fact of life, and then never knowing, for a mind like hers, it makes you almost pity people that didn't have the ability that we do to Google something and know right away.
Or admire what they sacrificed to travel.
Yeah.
Whether they were traveling because they were missionaries, or traveling because they were scientists, or traveling because they were running away, or they were in commerce. You know, what amazed me, the whole book begins with Alma's father, who's sort of a cabin boy assistant botanist on one of Captain Cook's final voyages around the world. And they were gone for 4 years, you know, 4 years without hearing from your family, 4 years without knowing if you would ever see anybody again. And the missionaries who I write about in the novel, too, would get a letter maybe once every 2 years from somebody at home. And sometimes it would be moldy and rotted, you know, which is even worse and sadder. You imagine opening an envelope that's been at sea for 2 years from your wife, who you haven't seen in 10 years, and it just falls out and crumbles. I mean, there's something that we cannot even comprehend about the loneliness. It's almost interplanetary, you know, more than it is anything that we can relate to today. When I can text my husband from Australia in instant time, you can't even imagine what they must have suffered and what they must have pondered.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I have thought, you know, what if we weren't distracted by any of the technology we have, how much more time we would spend with our thoughts and really observing the world around us, rather than, you know, you observe the moss that's growing on the stone near your house. You don't go online and Google it or find a book and pull it down.
Right. Well, that's the other thing that made me excited about writing about 19th century science instead of anything contemporary. First of all, I could never write about contemporary science because it's beyond my grasp. You know, the 19th century was the last moment in Western history where a relatively educated, intelligent person could follow what was going on. Probably I've heard that Origin of Species is the last major scientific work that a civilian can comprehend.
That was 1859.
And that was quite a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, it's just become so molecular and complex that we can't even approach it. So I almost had to, if I wanted to write a book about science, I almost had to write it about that science. And even then it was straining me, you know, mm-hmm. as I was trying to figure it out. I couldn't follow the chemistry, but I could follow the geography and the geology and the botany a bit. But they were that was the era of the great expansive amateurs. They were sort of they knew a little bit about everything and a lot about a lot of things. And that was before specialization, which is, I think, the other thing that's kind of cramped the human mind is that you wouldn't have somebody today who's a physicist and a botanist and a chemist and an inventor. You can't be all that stuff anymore because you can't keep up with it. But they could. And it was so exciting to see their great ranging minds.
I thought it took great restraint on your part to take a woman like Alma, who is so engaged, so smart, so driven, who today would be running a corporation or president of a university or, you know, in some position in government or something, and have her want to do what she wants to do, but she's not necessarily possessed of these radical thoughts about being a woman and the limitations that places on her. And it's so tempting to sort of take someone with a 21st century mind and pop them in
right.
and try to like have them change the world. But it's not the way the world worked.
And she wasn't a blue stocking. You know, mm-hmm. she wasn't politicized. She was a scientist. She had her face buried in her microscope and her book. She had no comprehension of what was going on in the social world around her to a fault. It's actually sort of an important theme of the book that she's not attending to questions of anybody else because she's like most of us when we get myopic about what we're excited about. She's only thinking about that. And I think that's pretty realistic for the era. A lot of those women scientists, they weren't engaged in questions about whether women should have the vote. They didn't really care.
Right.
You know, they were really busy trying to identify six new carnivorous swamp plants, you know, like in the same way that scientists today can sometimes be sort of detached from the politicized debate. Somebody asked me the other day, is this a feminist novel? And I said, well, I'm a feminist novelist, but mm-hmm. Alma's not a feminist person because she wasn't thinking about that.
Yeah.
And she could have been if she'd been looking around. It was going on around her. She just wasn't tuned into it.
Well, she's also a great example of the way that we can all be selfish without really being deliberately cold-hearted. You know,
right.
She's not trying to neglect everything else in her life. It just doesn't occur to her to sort of look up from the microscope for a long time.
Yeah, for a long time. And in that way, she almost is a little bit on the autistic spectrum, I think, in a way.
It makes
you know?
Perfect sense.
Like
that
a little
she's
bit.
Obsessed. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's so not. I mean, that was a really interesting sort of psychological challenge for me to write because it's not how I am. I'm a bleeding empath. I'm the permeable membrane. I feel everything. I hear everything. I witness everything. I'm so engaged in the lives of people around me. But I wanted to write about somebody who is in many ways profoundly different from me. And I thought that that's kind of what a scientist's mind is. It's a narrow point of focus. And there's a difference between being self-absorbed and being selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute that her head is finally spun around when the circumstances of her life pile up and even she has to finally pay attention to what's been going on around her the whole time, she's jarred out of that self-absorption and we see her great generosity. But you know, it almost takes a car accident for her to see it, to put an anachronistic metaphor in there. And I think that's sometimes the case with certain people.
So I read straight through and sort of resented any interruptions as I was going through the book. But I did stop at one point and spend about 45 minutes looking for images of water spouts.
Did you find some?
I did. I found pictures. I couldn't. I didn't find a lot of good video.
I have a good one on my iPhone. I can show you.
I'll
later.
Have to see it after the show because it's fascinating. And I mean, imagine a time when people didn't even really know what caused these things.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
And I borrowed that description. There's a moment in the book where Alma is at sea, and suddenly suddenly the sea goes deadly quiet, and the sky turns green, and then all of a sudden there are these five columns of water spouts, these water tornadoes essentially surrounding the ship. And it's the only time she'd ever seen these hardened sailors on the whaler that she's on go sort of sick with fear.
Mm-hmm.
And for her, it's this epic divine moment that she later thinks of as having been the happiest moment of her life.
Yeah.
Because it was, she's so fascinated by the workings of the natural world. And to be able to witness something like that, she didn't even care if she died. But the description came from the accounts that I read of missionaries at sea describing this terror, you know. I mean, it's biblical. You can imagine what that would do to a person of faith to suddenly see something that alarming and have no name for what it even is.
I love the missionary character's sort of pragmatic openness to taking people as they are and letting go of everything that you were taught about the right way to communicate faith to another person.
Yeah, that, you know, that was a really tricky character for me to write because I knew there had to be a missionary in the book. You can't go to the South Seas in the 1850s and not have a missionary there. You just can't.
If you want anyone to
talk to.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it just wouldn't be realistic that she wouldn't have encountered that. And also, a lot of the missionaries were really great naturalists, as men of God often were, men of science before there was that big divorce between science and religion that we're still working out the details of right now.
And there's no conflict for Alma either between those two.
Nope. She's okay with it, too. Mm-hmm. And so he's a great naturalist, the Reverend Francis Wells, who she meets in Tahiti, and also somebody who has been so far away from the civilized, air quotes, world and from the London Missionary Society's rules about how we are to engage with the natives, that he's been there for 50 years on this island and he's just had to adapt to this real reality of how Christianity is interpreted here. And he rolls with it in a way that makes him be the only missionary who can stay while the others are defeated by it or furious by it or driven out by it. And I also thought it would be interesting to write about somebody who's a better Christian than he is a missionary. Hmm. If the definition of Christianity is to love your neighbor and to be kind and good, and the definition of a missionary is to convert them, he's really good at loving them and he's pretty terrible at converting them because he just doesn't have the fire in his belly for anything more than love.
But somehow he makes it work.
He makes it work. He keeps his little church going and it becomes... You know, it's interesting if you travel to Brazil or to parts of Africa and you see the way that Christianity sort of blends with whatever was there before. Mm-hmm. And the really, you know, the more loosey-goosey kind of open-minded sects are – they allow the native saints to kind of mix in there a little bit. And they, you know, they make – you know, there's a great moment where the Reverend Francis Wells is trying to explain to Alma – the position on the island about ghosts and spirits, mm-hmm. which is a very un-Christian idea, but something that's deeply embedded in the local culture and how he kind of makes these weird, these sort of elliptical leaps of the imagination in his own mind to say that these people are both devout Christians and they absolutely believe in ghosts and they know they're not real, but they believe in them anyway.
Elizabeth Gilbert is my guest. Her new book is called The Signature of All Things. It's a novel. She is also known for her best-selling memoir, Eat, Pray, Love. She's in town to speak at Highland Park United Methodist Church, and we will continue our conversation with her in a few minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Right now, we are picking back up for a little while our fall fundraising campaign. We have $24,103 left to raise from listeners. And I say from listeners because friend of the station, board member of KERA, Donna Wilhelm, has offered today to match dollar for dollar every contribution that comes in. So that means if you're giving $5 a month, it becomes $10 a month, thanks to Donna. If you are giving a friends level membership of $1,500, that becomes $3,000 that benefits KERA. So it's the perfect time if you've waited until now to go online to kera.org or to call 888-694-6931. Help put all the folks that work here at KERA back to full-time producing content and away from fundraising. Jeff Whittington is back in with us now. He is executive producer of Think and a variety of other programs.
So, and sorry, Chris, I had too many things going on. I need to go back to that regular schedule.
Go back to the regular schedule of programming.
Put me back to work with my regular schedule by making a contribution at 888-694-6931. Or going online to kera.org. Chris, the number that's left to raise from listeners is ticking down, but you know, it's ticking down a little too slowly. And I have a lot of experience with these membership campaigns and selecting guests and working with the audience to help you take that step, to, you know, get off the fence about supporting the station. And I think we are in that realm of a guest who has very graciously agreed to sit here during fundraising breaks in the studio with us. It's not that exciting. That what she's seeing is not that exciting, but in my opinion. But I think maybe you are so interested in what Elizabeth Gilbert has to say that you don't really want to leave the conversation to make your contribution.
You've got 3 minutes and some change of just Jeff and me. So this an ideal time to get it all done. You can be back off the phone, offline, in time for us to pick the conversation up again. We do have thank you gift copies of The Signature of All Things, Elizabeth Gilbert's new novel. It's available with a minimum contribution of $10 a month. But please don't let that stop you. If you were going to give $20 or $30 or $50, make that happen for KERA. And we will be delighted to send it to you. Most important is your participation in this station, because there are costs to produce this kind of programming, to bring guests in, to have locally produced programming. A lot of stations in other markets can't have a show like Think, can't have a show like Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. We're very fortunate in this market to be able to do that for you, but it's a direct result of contributions from people like you and me who believe public radio is important. Join the station and all come together to make it happen.
And if you've ever thought, you know, someday I'm going to give a couple $100 to the radio station, well, today is the day to do it, my friends, because your contribution in any amount, right now, will be matched dollar for dollar by Donna Wilhelm, who's a board member of the station, a longtime generous supporter of the station as well. And she wants us to get back to the regular schedule just as badly as you do, just as badly, just as necessarily as we all need to. You know, there's an election tomorrow. Tomorrow's election day. Our reporting team is figuring out how to cover the election tomorrow. We're launching a brand new initiative called One Crisis Away tomorrow morning on Morning Edition. And we're going to have a show on Think on Wednesday about that. We've got things going on, and we really need to get back to focusing on the work that you appreciate, the work that you depend upon when you tune in to KERA. So if you've ever thought about making that big leadership gift or any gift at all to the station, this is the moment to do it at 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org.
If you were with us last hour, you might have heard our interview with neuroscientist Rick Hansen, who said that there is an actual measurable happiness boost that comes from philanthropy. So treat yourself to that today. Start your week off right and help KERA get back to the kind of programming that we all appreciate and want to have on our air here and also online. Many of you come to us now not just over the sort of terrestrial radio station, but you get to us online at kera.org. You might listen to the podcast of this show.
And if you listen long enough to the membership campaign, you're probably hearing us in your head while you lay down to go to sleep at night as
well.
It's
like when you play Tetris and the things still fly through your head.
Yeah, you're still jumping on the trampoline.
Right.
Even while you're laying in bed. 888-694-6931 on the web at kera.org. You can see that the total is going down as you look at kera.org. $22,733 left to raise. Please be the next one to call. Please be the next one to give online.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Elizabeth Gilbert, author of the best-selling memoir Eat, Pray, Love, and the brand-new novel The Signature of All Things. She's in town to speak tonight at Highland Park United Methodist Church. You can find information on the Think page. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Liz, when you are known for writing a memoir, two memoirs, how does that affect the kinds of information that people share with you about their own lives?
Well, I've had no particular boundaries about the kind of information I share with people about my life, and so I think they respond in kind.
is that a burden ever?
No, it's lovely. You know, and my fans are the nicest and kindest and sweetest, most self-deprecating human beings in the world. You know, it tends to be women. Mm-hmm. So first of all, you know, they're lovely. they're not teenagers. I don't have, Twilight's fans, or they're not Stephen King's fans. They're not weird. You know,
right,
they're
right.
Like lovely people who responded to the book because, for the most part, it mirrored their own desire to try to live better, more creative, more interesting, more compassionate lives. So when they approach me, usually they just want to say thank you for writing a book that I cared about so much. Every once in a while, they want me to, you know, chime in on whether or not they should get divorced. I try to make it very clear that there are limits to how much I can answer that question when I don't know any of the people in that story.
Right.
You know, but I can certainly say, listen, you know, I've been where you are, and I've come out on the other side and met a lot of other people who have, and you will too. And sometimes I think that's the only thing anybody really needs to hear.
Yeah. Did you know, I mean, when you were writing that, that would be sort of the big breakout for you?
No. On the contrary, it seems so impossible to imagine this given what became of it, but it felt like I was taking an enormous risk and also that I would maybe was throwing away what I had of a career.
You were doing literary journalism, essentially.
I was doing literary journalism, and I was known, if I were known at all, I was known as a woman who wrote exclusively for and about men. I wrote for Spin magazine. I wrote for GQ. My previous book had been called The Last American Man. The book before that was Stern Men. If I wrote about women, it was, you know, one woman in a man's world, but mostly I wrote about men, and I was known as a very sympathetic writer about men, which is how I had my job at GQ, and I was very comfortable there. But I knew when I quit that very good job and set out to go on that journey that I was taking myself in a completely different direction into a kind of exposed emotionality that I had avoided up until that point, and it felt really risky, and I thought, I'm going to lose the 20 readers that I have. and in fact, I probably did lose the 20 readers that I had, but it was replaced with several million other ones, which I could not possibly have anticipated. Nobody could have possibly anticipated what was going to happen.
Did writing for and about men shield you from having to face up to that exposed emotionality?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if you want to avoid your emotionality, you can't do better than to hang around. So that worked. And also, I was really fascinated with men. I think I've always been comfortable around men, and I'm not afraid of them, and I don't feel like they're an alien species, you know, and I wanted to kind of come to know them. And I think also in my 20s especially, I was sort of living out a man's life, having grown up, as many of us do, in households where the men just seemed to have tremendous liberties and autonomy and power, and the women just seemed very tired. It didn't feel to me, I mean, I can see this now in retrospect, it didn't feel like the aspirational thing would be to try to live a life like those women had. It seemed like a much more interesting and free thing to live the way the men did, which was to kind of do whatever they wanted. So I was sort of intentionally pushing that, I think.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mindy in Plano. Hi, Mindy.
Hi, buongiorno, grazie.
Oh, buongiorno. I hope we're not doing this whole thing in Italian or it's going to be a very short conversation, amore.
Va bene, okay.
Va bene, tesoro.
I would really love to know as a writer, and thank you so much for all your time today, both of you. I'd love to know as a writer how your physical writing process has changed over the past 20 years about getting it from your brain to paper, whether via technology or writing it out, and do you write, you know, when and where and how, and do you schedule it, and just how does your creative process become, you know, methodical?
Thank you, Wendy. Mindy, sorry. It's changed in some ways a great deal. We didn't have word processors when I began my career. I've changed my own kind of habits. I used to write every single day, which is, I think, something you really need to do when you're a young aspiring writer. And now I write seasonally. I write project by project. I think that's more efficient for me at this point. And I allow myself, I'm also able kind of financially and in my own life to set aside 6 months and say, I'm going to write the book during this 6 month period, which is something I never could have done when I had 3 part-time jobs. So, so that's changed. In other ways, it hasn't changed at all. I still do all my preparation for writing books on index cards, written by hand and stored in shoeboxes. If anybody ever brings a better system to life than that for organizing facts and information, I would be interested to know it. But nothing is more tactile, satisfying, and helpful to me than stacks and stacks and stacks of index cards filled with facts and ideas and sentences organized by character and chapter and subject. Seems to just be the only way I can do it.
Did you have fun coming up with the names for this novel?
The characters' names?
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very much so. And they are, Barbara Kingsolver in her review in the New York Times pointed out, they are very Dickensian, that there are
Retta
clues.
Snow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tomorrow Morning.
Tomorrow Morning. And, and of course, Ambrose Pike.
Ambrose Pike,
who
yeah.
is both sweet and stabbing. Mm-hmm. it was kind of lovely to come up with them. That's one of the joys. And then you find out later, for instance, the word Alma means soul. And that felt really important to me because she's the soul of the book. And it's really, you know, her soul that we're examining in this book. And then I found out on Facebook, this is the great thing about Facebook, from a reader in Hungary, that in Hungarian it means apple, and her ancestors were all orchardmen,
right.
In the apple orchards of Kew Gardens. And so that just felt like a happy coincidence when those kind of things align.
You have Joseph Banks as a minor character, and of course he was an actual figure in history. Was
uh-huh.
it fun to sort of imagine the role he might have played, and did you have to be really careful about not overstating his relationship to your fictional character?
Well, I've never done that before because, mm-hmm. well, I've never written historical fiction before. And there's two pretty significant characters in the book who are real people. It's Sir Joseph Banks and Alfred Russel Wallace, mm-hmm. the great naturalist and co-discoverer of evolution along with Darwin. And it was interesting to choose who goes in. You know, I felt comfortable with Banks and Wallace. I would not have felt comfortable with Darwin. You know, and here comes Mr. Darwin and his big gray beard.
Well,
you know,
it almost made the book about something else,
yeah,
because people know him so well.
Yeah, like I think you have to be careful. Like, and here's Mr. Franklin walking, and there's, yeah, Abraham Lincoln. Like, I always feel a little alarmed when those people show up in novels. But I think the more minor characters of history you can sort of play with a bit because we don't know their personalities as intimately. And I have to say that I had forgotten the joys of novel writing because I hadn't done it in so long, and all I'd remembered was the suffering, sort of the opposite of how women experience labor, where they only remember how happy they forgot how painful it was. I only remembered how painful it was, and I forgot the delights of the freedom and the autonomy and the creative leaps that you can take. And the first scene of dialogue in the book is, of course, between Sir Joseph Banks and my fictitious character, young Henry Whittaker. And I was giggling while I was writing it because I felt like, I can't believe you can do this. You can take a real character and put them with a fake character. And so, like, there's this wicked joy in it, you know. And I had forgotten that that's the kind of delight of the expansiveness of fiction.
How easy is it for you? Do you know at the outset always what the conclusion will be?
I do, but it's earned, that knowledge. I mean, I don't know it when I start the research,
mm-hmm.
But I know it when I start the writing, or I have. I may do it differently someday, but with this book in particular, because it's such a big, expansive book, it takes place from 1760 to 1880, over continents with all these different sort of ideas woven in there, I felt that it was imperative to leave nothing unknown before I began. So I wrote a 70-page outline of the novel before I started. So I was really mapped out, and I knew that I wasn't going to get lost in the plot or take a wrong turn. And that's something I think I've learned just over the years to make my life easier when I'm writing as well. A lot of the blockage that you get as a writer is often because you just don't know where you're going. You know, you're driving without a map. So if you can give yourself a map beforehand, I think it's better. But when I embarked on the project, I knew nothing other than the vaguest shadowy ideas. I want this to be about a powerful woman. I want it to be about 19th century science. I want it to be about the divisions between the rational world and the spiritual world. And that's about it. And then you got to fill in the rest from there.
How did you, what did it take to learn about moss enough to write the book?
Yeah, well, a lot. Unfortunately, I had a tremendous guide. There's a woman named Dr. Robin Wall Kimmerer who wrote a beautiful book called Gathering Moss. And she is both a bryologist and a poet. And this memoir that
she
wrote.
Such a great combination.
Right? And I discovered her book, and she sort of became my spirit guide through the writing and the research of the novel. And then I read a lot of her work, and so I drew a lot from there. I also spent a lot of time at the New York Botanical Garden Library studying the work of the original curator of mosses, a woman named Elizabeth Britton, who was one of the co-founders of the New York Botanical Gardens around the turn of the 19th century. And she left very, very detailed and vigorous, rigorous notes about her moss collecting, so I was able to borrow a lot from her life. But it was an interesting moment. Before I began writing, I took a pilgrimage to visit the author of Gathering Moss, this woman who I admired from afar for 3 years, who had been sort of my hero. And I wrote her a letter and asked her if I could come and see her. And I sat at her kitchen table in upstate New York, and we ate a quiche and drank tea. And I took an hour and a half and I, with her great patience, told her from beginning to end exactly what I wanted to do with this novel and asked her whether it was scientifically and historically plausible. And she said, yeah, you're good. And I drove home from there and started writing the next day feeling like I had been given permission from the principal's office, you know, to embark on this. It's almost like defending your thesis in front of your doctoral advisor.
Well, it seems to have worked out perfectly. You got an A and you got the PhD.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Gilbert's new novel is called The Signature of All Things. She's in town to speak tonight at Highland Park United Methodist Church. Liz, it's been such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it, and good luck on your fund drive. Everybody, passionately support public radio. It is one of the only bastions we have against the dark march of ignorance. And I cannot encourage everyone strongly enough to join in this fund drive. I'm really honored to have been able to be here today.
Thank you so much. Jeff Whittington has joined us now at 888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org.
I think Liz Gilbert's going to stay for a few minutes.
Well, she may have a commitment, so she can give us a couple minutes.
Yeah, I'll stick around for a while because it's a worthy, worthy cause.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. We're really excited to offer a copy of Elizabeth Gilbert's new book, When You Make a $120 Contribution Today. And, of course, the book is out. It's very widely and well-reviewed. We would encourage you to pick up a copy. We're just saying thanks when we offer thank you gifts, of course. The real thing you get is the radio station, and you listen to public radio, obviously, in your hometown.
Yeah, it's where I wouldn't know a thing in the world if it weren't for public radio. And I remember once listening to a fund drive, and the thing that got me was the person who said, don't be selfish. Don't be the one who listens for free while everybody else pays. And I just thought, okay. And that was probably 10 years ago. And I remember like going to the phone and picking up the phone and sort of obeying that command. And I think it's important to remember that. It's not fair to let everybody else buy your incredible radio for you. You have to show up yourself too.
Better words are never spoken. 888-694-6931 is our telephone number. You can also make your contribution at kera.org. $21,974 left to raise. It bears saying, and we've mentioned it before, Jeff, you and I are both members of the station. Most of the people who work here are members of the station. Mm-hmm.
Not
because
not required.
No one has ever told us we had to be, but we believe in the product. We use the product.
We too
would know nothing if not for public radio.
Yeah, and I was just a listener long ago, got lucky enough to get a job here as the Special Events Department Administrative Assistant when I started. It's scary to say it out loud. That's where I learned the importance of carrying a clipboard around. It's really important.
You can get away with a lot.
Scary to say it, but it was almost not quite two decades ago, but it's been a while. And, you probably listen because you love the station and you love what you get from KERA. That's what brought me here as an employee years ago. I was a listener for years before I came to work at the station. And you just don't find it. You don't find what you get here anywhere else. And that's why you keep coming back. And that's why you're listening right now on this, the second week of our fundraising drive. I mean, this is your station. You're addicted.
Exactly. You're still here until we don't want to call it the bitter end. It should hopefully be a wonderful, happy, satisfying ending for all of us. Your contributions really do keep the station going. You are the lifeblood of KERA. It's not the people who work here. We're thrilled to be here, but it really is. We're here for you. We're here to serve you, and we're here because of you. Your contribution does matter at 888-694-6931 or at kera.org. Whether it is $5 a month or $1,500 a year or more or less or somewhere in between, your money goes to work for you, providing news and information, quality journalism for North Texas. We've expanded our local presence in journalism because we know that's something that you need and want. Donna Wilhelm is helping us shorten our drive. Your money is being matched dollar for dollar today. So please take that small step of becoming a member of this station.
Yeah, we're talking about an instantaneous 100% return on your investment. If you give $100 today to the station, it represents a $200 contribution. If you give $200 to the station today, it represents a $400 contribution to the station. That's really, really powerful. And thanks so much to Donna Wilhelm, KERA supporter and board member, longtime board member of the station, who is helping us to wrap up this membership campaign today. Chris, there's less than $22,000 left to raise. I think we could do it in just a number of minutes if you'll make your phone call to 888-694-6931, if you will go online to kera.org and make a contribution.
We are always delighted to hear from those of you who listen to the show on a regular basis, whether it's over the air or during the rebroadcast or even in the podcast or maybe on your computer, maybe you stream it live. All of those sources are available to you because we want to be here for you in every possible format. Your contributions allow us to do this at 888-694-6931 or kera.org. You can get a copy of Elizabeth Gilbert's book, The Signature of All Things. I truly love this novel. It's available with a contribution of $10 a month or more.
What a great interview with her. And thanks so much to her for being with us today. Thanks so much to you for being with us. Please be the next one to be with us. 888-694-6931. Or do it online at kera.org.
We really appreciate your participation. We do need to hear from all of you today to get that matching donation from Donna Wilhelm. Please do your part now at kera.org.